audiobooks are a big business. Over the years, they've gone from books on tape to CDs to downloads. Now they can make another big move from paying per title to streaming. Last year, Spotify announced a new program to offer 15 free hours of audiobooks to premium customers at no extra cost. If that model expands, our next guest says the publishing industry will go through a radical transformation, similar to the one the music industry has done over the last few decades, with vanishing profit for artists and potentially a shrinking market for new material. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you listen to audiobooks? How and where do you get them? And do you use Spotify? How has Spotify changed the way you listen to music? Could it change the way you read, or in this case, listen to, books? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Kim Scott is the author of the book Radical Candor, Be a Kick-Ass Boss Without Losing Your Humanity and Radical Respect, and a former technology executive in the past working at Google, Apple, and elsewhere. Kim, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much. I'm excited for our conversation.
All right, I gave a very basic taste of how the Spotify book model would work. Spell it out for us a little more, please.
So basically what will happen is if you're a Spotify premium user, as far as I understand, you will be able to, instead of listening to music or listening to a podcast, you'll be able to choose 15 hours worth of audiobooks. And so if you start reading a book that is only 10 hours and you read, you know, only a couple hours of it and you get bored, then you can start another book. So it sounds pretty good for users. The problem is what it does for writers. On average, when a person starts an audiobook, they listen to about half of it. And so right off the bat, Spotify is only going to pay authors 50% of what they would otherwise get. If you go to Audible and buy an audiobook, even if you only listen to half of it, the writer still gets paid their royalty. And it's not like writers are getting rich. I want to say that, too. It's not like... You know, even for a pretty successful book, I think writers already make only about $1 a book or something.
Now, you, in a piece in the New York Times, compare this to how Spotify and some other streaming platforms have changed music.
Yes.
Could you talk through what you see happening there that could make this audiobook change scary, especially for the creators?
So basically what has happened in the music industry is that the music labels were, they sort of handed over their whole, you know, all of the songs that they had ever produced to Spotify. And now musicians get paid very, very little. There are a few musicians who get paid well, but it's very much a rich get richer algorithm on Spotify. So a small number of musicians are getting all of the money. And if you want to break into the music business and you're a successful but not a wildly successful musician, you get paid basically nothing. And that is, it means that it's impossible to make a living for most musicians, just as it will become even harder than it already is to make a living as a writer.
You point toward a paradox in that piece I mentioned. The idea is, hey, streaming makes it easy for you, band people, musicians, to create music and things like that. But it may be harder because people can't make a living doing it. We are actually seeing a decline in some cases in fresh new content.
Yes. The new music that is being launched, that the size of that business has actually shrunk because people can't afford to be musicians. And this is something, you know, I have some personal experience with. Earlier, before I became a writer, I managed the AdSense network at Google. And we used to say at Google, and we believed this, I mean, our intentions were truly good. We would say we're funding creativity a nickel at a time. You know, now you can just, if you want to write something, you can publish it, you can put ads against it, and you can start making money right away. But the problem, of course, is that the only people who made enough money to put food on the table were the upper 1/10 of 1% of people who were in the network. And the rest of people were making, you know, even people producing great content were making like $5 a month. And that's just not enough to live on.
We're talking to Kim Scott, author of the book Radical Candor, former technology executive. She wrote a piece about Spotify getting into the audiobooks market. Instead of paying for a title, say, you would, as part of your membership, get to stream a certain amount. She says that could really shake up the audiobook business in a way that's bad for people who want to write and create books. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you an audiobook listener? How do you do it? Are you an author? Are you worried about this change? If you're a musician, how has streaming changed your musician life? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. All right, Kim, we've talked about the music streaming as maybe a sign of things to come for audiobooks. Now, in the publishing world, first of all, people might say, oh, audiobooks, no big deal. The main thing is we read books, right? Well, as I understand it, audiobooks these days, big business, big part of the publishing industry's business model.
Yes, and crucially, it's the growing part. In fact, the number of physical books that have been sold has actually declined in the last 5 years. But the audiobooks portion of the market is what's really growing. Because, like, I don't know about you, but I'm busy. I read probably, as my children say, you don't read them, you listen to them, Kim and Mom. but I listen to, probably 3 books a week. But the only reason I have time to do that is because I listen while I'm taking a walk, while I'm doing the dishes, while I'm weeding, while I'm doing other things. And I think that's why that part of the market is growing, is that it's really convenient to listen to a book while you're commuting to work or something.
Now, talk us through how publishers are reacting to this thing from Spotify. Are they panicking and boycotting, or are they jumping in and saying, yes, please, line up our catalogs, let's see what happens?
Well, different publishers are reacting differently. I'm proud to say that my publisher, which is St. Martin's Press, gave me a choice as the writer. Did I want to participate or did I not want to participate? But there are some other publishers who just sort of handed over their whole portfolio of audiobooks and without asking permission of the authors. And I think that's pretty rough on the writers. And I think, the promise, I always like to listen to both sides. And Spotify, to their credit, they called me up, they explained it to me, and they believe, and I think they genuinely believe this, they believe that this is going to expand the number of readers for books. And so even though you'll only get, on average, half the royalty per reader, you'll get so many more readers, you'll make up for it in volume. I haven't seen any data that proves that is true. And my assumption is that it's incorrect, but I could be wrong here. I mean, I'm not omniscient, but what I know about the way that platforms work, technology, and I know something about this from my previous career, mm-hmm. What I know about the way that tech platforms work says to me that what'll happen is the tech platform will get a bunch of users because they'll be offering this great deal on the content. And then they'll start taking more and more and more out of the content creator's piece of the action because they can, because the content creators kind of have to be on the platform. And then the content creators can no longer afford to create content, so they go get quote-unquote real jobs.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Linda is with us in Pleasant Prairie. Linda, hi.
Hi. I have been listening to audiobooks for, probably at least 30 years. When I was working, I had a 2-hour commute every day, and
wow.
That really saved me. But it saved me. I'd look forward to getting in the car and listening to an audiobook. I still listen to audiobooks. I love it when I'm working or making pottery. I get mine through the library. I always have. I started with the cassette tapes and then the CDs. And now I download it directly onto my phone and listen that way. I am you know, Spotify thinks that 15 hours of an audiobook is a good deal.
Yeah, that's nothing, right?
It's nothing. Most of the books that I listen to are close to that length anyhow. So I'd be very concerned about this, and I think that artists should get paid well for what they do. It'd be very, very sad if we just kind of make this into almost a sort of plastic experience where everything's kind of the same.
Linda, thanks a lot for the call. Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead, Kim.
No, I totally agree with you. And I want to sort of plus one what you said about libraries offer a wonderful service. And so many of my readers got my book from the library. So I love the library point. And I just read Middlemarch or listened to Middlemarch. And that's 32 hours. You know, it would have been terrible to stop in the middle of the book.
Thanks again for that call, Linda. We're talking to Kim Scott, author of the book Radical Candor, former executive at Apple and Google. She's talking with us about a piece she wrote for the New York Times. Remember what Spotify did to the music industry? Books are next. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on Spotify at least dipping its toes in this idea of streaming audiobooks, X amount of audiobook time for you with your membership? Are you an audiobook listener, reader? How do you do it? Do you want to see this streaming option, or do you want to just get the titles you want? If you're a writer or a music creator, because there's a similar story there, love to hear from you about your experiences. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about how Spotify may change the publishing industry by making audiobooks available as a streaming service. Our guest is Kim Scott, author of the book Radical Candor, former technology executive, in the past working at Apple, Google, and elsewhere. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you purchase audiobooks? Do you get them from the library? If they're part of a streaming service, Spotify or elsewhere, would you want to listen to them that way? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's go back to your calls. We've got J.A. with us in Phillips. J.A., hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, Rob.
What did you want to tell us about? You're an author, I understand.
I am an author. Been a professional full-time author since about 2001. And as far as big shot publishers go, mainstream publishers, the contracts are pretty much what you'd expect from any big business to artists. The contracts are unconscionable, and the authors make next to nothing for books that are sold. For example, when my books were in bookstores all over the nation and the world, or when they were in Walmart, on a $7.99, $8.99 paperback, an author makes about 40 to 50 cents. And that's if they're selling lots and lots of copies. It's less than that if they sell fewer than that. On a hardcover, $25 hardcover, you're going to make about $3. So I worked very hard in the publishing industry, and I sold hundreds of thousands of hardcovers and paperbacks in the fiction, mystery, thriller, and horror fields. And then, lo and behold, this company named Amazon came along, and Amazon invented this e-reader called a Kindle. And what's wonderful about the Kindle, other than the fact that it could deliver books to you instantly, anywhere where there's any sort of internet service. What else is wonderful about it for authors is it finally paid you as an author. So rather than getting 6% for a paperback off of the cover price, you're making 70% of the price you set. So on a $5 Kindle book, I'm making over $3.
Now, Jay, I want to ask, since we've got this audiobook thing going, have you done audiobooks either with a publisher or, since it sounds like you're self-publishing now?
Well, I've done both.
Mm-hmm.
Back in the day, the largest independent audiobook publisher was a publisher called Brilliance Audio, located out of Grand Haven, Michigan. And they were great to work with. They were a lot of fun. I got to appear as a voice of some of my characters on many of my early audiobooks. And again, the pay was okay. I mean, you can't complain if you win the lottery and you finally get that dream agent and you get that publishing deal. And I made decent money publishing, but I didn't make as much as my publishers did. Both the print publishers and the audiobook publishers. So Brilliance would sell an audiobook for up to $40-$50 for library copies, and I'd make a couple of bucks or less than that.
Interesting. Jay, I'm going to jump in because we don't have a ton of time left, and I want to bring Kim here. Now, some authors have done really well in self-publishing, you know, e-books. There's a little more production, a whole other kind of production involved in audiobooks. Is this, do you see this as a possibility for authors to get around not just the publishers, but, say, a Spotify streaming platform if they're making their own audiobooks?
I think it's pretty hard. I mean, my experience, and I'd love to hear from the caller. I wrote 3 unpublished novels and self-published them. And I just wasn't able to get traction with those books in the way I did publishing through my publisher. So I did much better with a traditional publisher than I did on my own. But so hats off to this caller for figuring out how to sell his self-published books. There's a lot of different ways to read your books, to self-publish your books. There are very few authors I know of who have been able to succeed in that way. But I remain optimistic. I think that the idea of funding creativity a nickel at a time still appeals to me. I mean, it would be nice to live in a world in which anybody could write anything, put it out there in the world, and it would have a fair shot at getting discovered. But I don't think that's the world we live in yet.
Thanks a lot for that call again, J.A. Now, Kim, let's use the word discovered. And I want to talk about discovery because you write about this in your piece. You know, when you're on a streaming platform, any kind of streaming platform, an algorithm is going to make suggestions to you.
Yes.
We have a sense so far of what Spotify is recommending to us when we try to stream audiobooks.
Well, it would appear that they are recommending books that either are out of copyright, and so they don't have to pay anything for those books. So on the day that it launched, a lot of people were having Karl Marx recommended to them, which, you know, didn't seem like the thing that most of us
want to
read.
Seems like there might be some socialist programmer who, like, pranked that in there. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't think there's a lot of socialists working at Spotify, but I could be wrong. I think there was a Britney Spears book. So, and this is what happens. I said before that these kinds of tech platforms tend to have a rich get richer algorithm. And the reason for that is not necessarily insidious, but because the way that the algorithms work is that they figure out, you know, sort of what you're looking for. And then they also know what most other people like. And so they tend to recommend to you what most other people are reading. So, or listening to. And so as something gets more popular, it gets recommended more often, and then it gets more popular. That's what I mean by a rich get richer algorithm. And the problem with that is that if Spotify is sending most listeners to just a few different pieces of content, a few different books or a few different podcasts, then the so-called long tail, all these other smaller podcasts and books and musicians, they don't get discovered. Only the big ones do. But then there's another confounding factor, which is, you know, Spotify has maybe cut a deal with those really big musicians or authors or podcasters. And so it doesn't cost them incrementally more money to send you to them. And so they send more of you, more of that kind of content that they don't have to pay for your way. Or they can encourage people who on the other end of the spectrum, you know, who are teeny tiny, who've not yet been discovered and who are willing to give their content away for free in order to get discovered. And so then they wind up sending you this kind of content that you don't really want. And in the case of books, because of copyright, they may send you Das Kapital when that's not what you're interested in reading today.
And just our last few moments. Another problem. Now, we've already seen on Spotify, people are creating like noise tracks, gibberish tracks. YouTube, people are, you know, I have a 6-second Simpsons clip. That's what my channel is. People putting up stuff either free or AI created or copyright infringing. Yeah. That might be the wave of the future with these audiobooks.
Yes. I mean, once you add ads into the equation, then I think you all talked earlier this month about the, I'll call it the impoopification of content by this article by Cory Doctorow.
Right.
Once you create ads and anybody can put up gibberish and then put ads next to it and make money. That really messes up the program. And then there's another thing to consider, which is the market. The stock market is rewarding. So I don't blame the CEO of Spotify for doing what he's doing. I would probably do the same thing if I were the CEO of Spotify, because I'd get punished by the market if I didn't do it. And so I think the only way, I went to business school, blah, blah, blah. But I think the only way, the only solution is some regulation, unfortunately, because if the logic of the algorithm and the logic of the market is pushing things in a way that is bad for content creators and ultimately bad for society, that's why we have regulation. That's why we have a government to take care.
Thanks to our guest, Kim Scott, author of the book Radical Candor. We've been talking about Spotify streaming audiobooks in the future. This is Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Since about 2009, the U.S. has seen a steady increase in the number of pedestrian deaths. That came after decades where the trend was toward more pedestrian safety. So what happened around then that made life more dangerous for us when we're walking? Our next guest looked at the numbers and talked to a lot of researchers. The puzzling thing is no one can give one definitive answer about why this is happening, and especially why such a large number of those deaths occur at night. We do have some insights about how we can chart a new path forward that makes the streets safer for everybody. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you walk to work or to school or to do errands? If so, do you feel safe with that nearby traffic? Or do you worry about possible run-ins with cars or other motorists? Does being a pedestrian part of the time change the way you think about driving when you're behind the wheel? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Emily Badger is a reporter for the New York Times, where she writes about cities and urban policy for the Upshot section from the Washington Bureau. Emily, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
All right. Overall numbers of pedestrian deaths tragically going up, but a lot of that driven by what's happening after dark. What are we seeing there? What kind of trends are we seeing when it comes to those nighttime incidents?
So it's been very apparent to transportation planners and engineers that we have had this crisis of traffic safety, particularly for pedestrians, where deaths have been rising in the United States since about 2009, what you mentioned. But the thing that we discovered in this project that we recently published at the New York Times is that the vast majority of those deaths, more than 85% of them, the rise since 2009, those deaths have come at night. It is specifically pedestrians dying while it is dark in the United States that is really sort of driving this problem of worsening traffic safety. And, you know, that sort of takes this mystery that a lot of people have been puzzling over, and it makes it even harder to solve, I think. You know, we're trying to answer this question, what is it that is happening particularly at night? You know, what is it that has been happening particularly since 2009? And, you know, when we look at other countries, other comparable industrialized countries, they don't have patterns like this. So we're also trying to figure out, you know, what is it that is unique to the United States and our roads and the way we drive here that's causing more pedestrians to die at night?
People might think, okay, well, there's going to be one obvious answer. And actually, you did a follow-up column where readers suggested the obvious answer. But when you talk to a lot of the experts, there isn't one magical cause, if I'm reading you right, Emily.
Yeah, I think that that's the right way to think about it. And, you know, I don't think it's that, you know, we just didn't turn over enough rocks and we never found the one magical thing. I think there is not one magical thing. I think that, you know, several things have been happening simultaneous to each other over these last 15 years in the U.S. And, you know, some of them are more obvious than others. You know, this is the time period over which smartphones become ubiquitous in the United States and they become this big source of driver distraction. You know, this is a time period during which vehicles are getting a lot bigger. It's a time period during which, you know, the screens inside of our vehicles are getting bigger and brighter and more complicated. So, you know, a lot of things are happening. And at the same time, we think there are things happening outside of the vehicle as well. We think that, you know, more Americans are moving to parts of the country that have worse infrastructure for pedestrians, you know, these Sunbelt metro areas. You know, the rise of homelessness is probably contributing to this as well, because literally we're talking about very vulnerable people who are living near highway interchanges and under road underpasses. So, you know, all of these things are not sort of deriving from one single obvious factor, but they may very well all be contributing to this problem at the same time.
Emily Badger stays with us from the Washington Post as we talk about pedestrian safety, especially at night. Turning toward Wisconsin, we've seen similar trends with a peak in pedestrian deaths during COVID. Things got a little better last year, though. Earlier today, I talked to Robert Schneider, professor of urban planning at UW-Milwaukee. Here's that conversation. All right, I've been looking at these charts. Nationwide, pedestrian deaths were going down and down over the years, and then we had this jump during the COVID era nationwide. Maybe we've gone down a bit in Wisconsin again. We'll take a look at that in a bit. But what were you looking at as you're seeing those numbers of pedestrian deaths going up again?
Yeah, well, it's a tragic thing when we have any traffic fatalities. And that's why a number of states and local communities are aiming towards Vision Zero, which is ultimately having zero traffic deaths on our highways and streets. But in the last 10 years, we've been going in the wrong direction. For pedestrian fatalities, we had a low of about 4,100 pedestrian fatalities across the country in 2009. And the most recent data from 2021-2022, it's in the 7,000 range in terms of pedestrian fatalities. And when we look at the data, one of the things that sticks out is that many of the new fatalities that we're seeing, the additional 3,000 or so per year, are happening at night.
Yeah.
About 85% of those are occurring at night.
And we're talking to Emily Badger today, who's been reporting on this and breaking down those nighttime numbers. What are you looking at for possible causes in this jump in pedestrian fatalities at night?
Yeah, there are a number of things. I don't think anybody can really pinpoint a single factor, but we look in our research at some of the underlying factors related to roadway design and the characteristics of the system that we've developed. For example, the lighting conditions at night make it harder to see pedestrians crossing the street. So the average driver is going to see somebody slightly later and think about starting to stop at a slightly later time as a driver than they would during the daytime. That means there's less reaction distance and time, meaning the chances of a collision occurring at night versus daytime are higher, and the speed of the impact that happens is likely to be higher at night as well. So visibility is a key factor at night, and one of the things that exacerbates the risk is higher speeds.
Milwaukee is one of those cities that's aiming for zero pedestrian deaths, as I understand it, with a target of 2037. Are you seeing infrastructure changes coming into place that might help do that?
Yeah, there are a number of things being done by the City of Milwaukee Department of Public Works in collaboration with the Milwaukee County Department of Transportation and the Wisconsin State Department of Transportation. Many of the serious injuries and fatalities in Milwaukee are on main thoroughfares, and many of these are state highways. Capitol Drive is 190. Appleton Avenue is 175. There are many others, National Avenue, that have high concentrations of pedestrian injuries and some fatalities. And so actions that these agencies are taking are to do what are called rapid implementation projects. Things like temporary curb extensions have been added by flexible posts, but now in this last year, they've been making those concrete, which make it harder for drivers to pass on the right side of the roadway, which is a very dangerous behavior, and also reduce overall vehicle speeds, which is going to make pedestrians safer as well as all types of roadway users safer.
And let's wrap up, Robert, with a look at the behavioral side of things here. What should we as drivers be doing, you know, at dusk as it gets darker to try to adjust for the fact that, yeah, all of a sudden there's less visibility?
I think that one thing that we're often taught in driver's ed is to drive a safe speed for the conditions. And at nighttime, it gets dark. It gets harder to see. It's especially harder to see pedestrians, but other vehicles, bicyclists, others who are sharing the streets, it's harder to see. So you need to drive more slowly. As we think about it from a system perspective, we should also be thinking about, well, what streets can we have lower speed limits on that will reduce the baseline risk for drivers who are driving at night, and then the pedestrians, bicyclists, and other people who they may be interacting with. Ultimately, we want to create safer streets for everybody.
Bob, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Robert Schneider, UW-Milwaukee transportation safety expert. I talked to him earlier about pedestrian safety, especially at night. Emily Badger stays with us from the New York Times Washington Bureau. I briefly transferred her to the Washington Post. She's with the New York Times. Emily, we heard from Bob there some of the infrastructure changes people are talking about to try to make pedestrians safer. Is that what you were hearing from experts you talked to?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's helpful to look at what they are doing in other countries where they don't have this problem to the degree that we do. I mean, in most comparable European and Asian countries, for instance, you know, they have much lower levels of pedestrian fatalities, and they're trending downward, not upward. So the exact opposite thing is happening there. And, you know, so we ask, okay, what are they doing in those places? You know, they are not requiring pedestrians to wear neon-colored clothing. They are not, you know, requiring that everyone take their smartphones away, although they often have stricter rules about whether or not you can drive with them. You know, the kinds of things that they're doing that appear to be successful are really around infrastructure, you know, sort of investing in the actual physical roadway and ensuring that it's got safe pedestrian infrastructure, you know, that the speed limits on those roads are lower, that pedestrians actually have crosswalks, you know, that roads are designed to be serving not just cars, but also people who are riding their bikes on them, in addition to people who are walking on the sidewalk. You know, these are all things that sort of signal to a driver who's driving down the road, you know, you are sharing this road with other kinds of people who are more vulnerable than you, and you need to drive slower as a result of that. And, you know, some of those are the kinds of things that Bob was talking about in Milwaukee.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Karen is with us in Hollandale. Karen, hi.
Hi, it's nice to be on the call. I live in Madison, about a 10-minute walk from the square where the Capitol is, and that means that every time I have to go to a meeting or go to business, I need to walk through what's called the Nolan Willie Street Hairball, and that intersection was recently under reconstruction for almost 2 years. It was not safe beforehand. It was incredibly treacherous, like a minefield, while it was under construction. And now, unbelievably, it is less safe. There are fewer physical barriers between us and folks making a fast left turn onto Nolan. And we have to dodge multiple lanes of traffic, a swinging right turn, and two lanes of bike traffic.
Thanks a lot for the call. Emily, I'm not going to assume you're familiar with that particular intersection, but is this seen as a problem? Weird intersections, that one happens to be along a lake where multiple roads run into each other at weird angles, a train track, a bike tracks, things like that. Are eccentric intersections like this seen as part of our pedestrian safety problem?
It's absolutely the case that you know, we're more likely to see fatalities at intersections because, you know, intersections are complicated places where, you know, different groups of people traveling at different speeds and different modes are all coming into interaction with each other. And so, you know, this is part of the reason why a lot of communities, for instance, are pursuing laws that say no right turn on red. Like a right turn on a red is precisely the kind of condition that winds up having a driver drive into a pedestrian who thinks that they have the right of way, who's getting a signal that they have the right of way. And so, yeah, I mean, intersections in general, complicated intersections in particular, are precisely the kind of place where you just have lots of conflict points. And I think in general, you know, not being familiar with that specific intersection, you know, I think one of the things that has historically been the case with all of our road infrastructure in the United States is, you know, we've been asking ourselves, what are we optimizing for here? We've been optimizing to enable cars to drive as fast as possible, to get through the intersection quickly. And it's just a fundamental change in how we do things to say, you know, let's optimize for the safety of the most vulnerable people instead of the speed of the people who are going the fastest.
Thanks for that call, Karen. Emily Badger is with us from the New York Times, where she writes about cities and urban policy. We're talking about a rise in American pedestrian deaths over the last bunch of years, especially at night, and why it's been hard for researchers to pin down a single cause. But there are, as we're hearing, some solutions. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is it like for pedestrians in your community? If you want to go for a walk just for recreation or to get from point A to point B, can you? Do you feel safe? Is there a place to walk in Wisconsin, you know, on roadways, on sidewalks, and more that you feel is particularly safe or particularly unsafe? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up the conversation with Emily Badger from the New York Times about a nationwide rise in pedestrian fatalities starting around 2009 and a mystery why so many of those deaths, an increasing number over the years, happening at night. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your experiences, your questions, maybe your solutions to this problem. Join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Jay joins us now in Two Rivers. Jay, hi.
Yes, good afternoon. I'm wondering if the popularity of pickup trucks and SUVs that have their headlights mounted higher and the fact that the headlights are incredibly bright in some cases, unlike the old incandescents where they were limited in the light output, and that doesn't seem to be the case anymore. And on one of your previous programs, it was commented how the bluish LED lights tend to affect our night vision for quite a long time after we get lights in our eyes. So I'm wondering if that's got anything to do with it, that we're just getting blinded by the light.
Jay, thanks a lot for the call. Emily, this is something that's definitely come up as you were reporting on this.
Yeah, I mean, after we published this story, and this headlights in particular were not something we discussed in the story, we heard from hundreds of readers who said, I think it's LED headlights. You know, the timeline is sort of fits relatively well. They also, you know, sort of come onto the market and become quite common after this 2009 time period that we're talking about. And, you know, they are much brighter. It is absolutely true that they're brighter than previous incandescent headlights that people had. But in my conversations with a lot of different researchers about this, and including researchers who specifically study headlights and exactly how, you know, they affect people's vision, you know, there's a sense that in many ways headlights are getting better. You know, I think the fear is that they're, you know, in some ways they're getting worse because they create more glare and they're particularly a problem for oncoming vehicles or even pedestrians who get blinded by them. But the general sense in the industry is that, you know, headlights are better than they used to be. As they're brighter, they illuminate longer distances than they used to. And, you know, the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety, which sort of rates headlights and tracks, you know, how good they are and how they're changing over time, you know, they believe that headlights are getting better, that a larger share of cars on the road have headlights that are better. They try to assess, you know, how much glare is produced by those headlights. So, you know, I think that they are part of the puzzle here, but they're not quite the, you know, the sort of secret missing thing that people are not paying attention to, because, you know, at the same time as they are becoming brighter, you know, in some ways that's to the benefit of drivers, you know, that makes it easier for them to see. But, you know, another thing that the caller mentioned is that these brighter headlights are higher up on cars because they're attached to bigger cars, and certainly cars being bigger is part of the problem also.
Thanks a lot for that call, Jay. Paul joins us now in Milwaukee. Paul, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yes, I'm a semi-truck driver, and I'm also a self-described urban planning nerd. I watch City Nerd and Not Just Bikes on YouTube, where they talk about European city planning and how pedestrians are given a much better chance in those places than they are in the United States. When I was an over-the-road driver, I would park places and walk maybe a couple of miles to get to something interesting to go and see. And I walked in a lot of places that were not pedestrian-friendly, where I was walking next to a guardrail and between the guardrail and the roadway, and it was kind of terrible. I noticed that European cities have raised crosswalks, and the motor vehicles have to go up and over those crosswalks rather than pedestrians having to step down onto the roadway. They also have fewer slip lanes, which is a problem for pedestrians. I just heard the caller talking about LED headlights. One critique that I would make of those headlights is that although the headlights may be brighter and safer for drivers at night, they make it impossible for a pedestrian to see whether or not a directional signal is on those headlights in some cases. I would also argue that on vehicles, the turn signals are a single LED bulb in the midst of a chrome-plated box with all these facets in it. And when the sun is shining on that, good luck seeing that amber light somewhere in there.
I gotcha. Paul, we're just about out of time, but you gave us a lot to work with. Thanks for the call. Emily, Paul's point about some of those European infrastructure things, including raised pedestrian crosswalks, is that something that people here in the U.S. are looking at?
Yeah, both raised pedestrian crosswalks and these kind of bump outs at intersections where, you know, the sidewalk almost extends into the intersection so that the pedestrian is standing out in the corner in a way that makes them more visible before they even enter into the intersection. So these are kind of, you know, specific physical things that we could be doing to the environment, but it's going to take a very long time to do that to lots of intersections and lots of streets all over American communities.
Thanks again for that call. Emily, in our last minute or so, you reported on this. You talked to a lot of safety experts. Did you get the sense in your reporting that a lot of communities around the country are taking some of these ideas and trying to run with them?
I think that would be putting it in a way that's a little bit too optimistic, in part because, you know, part of what we have to change here is not just our infrastructure, but a culture of sort of prioritizing driving over walking, prioritizing speed over safety. And changing things like that is difficult. It takes time. It takes political capital. And even in many communities that are sort of ready to try to invest in street safety and pedestrian safety, you know, it's not going to be easy for them to do that, I think.
Emily, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That's Emily Badger, reporter for the New York Times, where she writes about cities and urban policy. She was with us for a look at why the United States is a uniquely dangerous place for pedestrians and what cities and transportation planners can do to make the streets safer for everyone. And early on, we heard from Robert Schneider, UW-Milwaukee transportation safety expert, for a look at what's going on here in the state. Still time for you to share what you're seeing, maybe in your own community. Is it safe? Do you feel safe walking from one place to another? What do you think your community is doing well? What would you like to see improve? What's your solution to pedestrian safety? Let us know. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Remember, you can follow these conversations all the time, anytime, online at WPR.org. You can stream live, and you can go back and listen to archived audio as well and share great discussions with your friends and family. You can also download the Wisconsin Public Radio app. I'm Rob Barrett. This is Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The latest numbers say the economy is doing pretty well when it comes to big picture numbers like employment, the stock market, and wages. Even inflation has slowed down. But many Americans continue to express concern and dissatisfaction with their own financial situation. You may have seen headlines like one from The Economist, "Why are Americans so gloomy about their great economy?" Our next guest found that a lot of people have some pretty good reasons to be uncertain about the economy and how it affects them. She's been talking to people all over the country about their economic concerns. Earlier this week, she co-wrote a piece in the New York Times about why, as the headline says, many Americans believe the economy is rigged. She joins us now to share what she found. You can join in at 800-642-1234. When you see news about the economy, do you feel like it reflects your own experience? What are your concerns when it comes to how the economy affects you? Do you feel precarious? Maybe things are okay right now, but you're not far from a big problem, potentially. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Kathy Kramer is professor of political science at UW-Madison, co-chair of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences Commission on Reimagining Our Economy. Kathy, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much, Rob. It's great to be here.
Well, sometimes when I look at coverage of this issue, you know, the economy looks good, big picture, people express discontent, there's almost a hint that, well, what's wrong with people? Why aren't they understanding the economy is good? You found, as you talk to people, a lot of good reasons for that.
Yeah, and one big one is that when we ask how is the economy doing, we often use these big indicators like levels of unemployment or inflation that are pretty far removed from people's lives. And what people see is the prices they're paying, right, or the level of credit card debt they have. And so we just went around the country and convened these small groups of people and listened to them and asked them, what are your challenges and what are you experiencing?
I want to talk a little more about the project that you did here. You were literally going around the country. Set the scene for us. How are you getting people together? How do these conversations shake out?
Well, the whole commission was organized around the idea that we needed to think about how well the American people are doing, aside from how well the economy is doing, to try to recommend things that would help create an economy where people, more people, a wide range of people can thrive. And we decided that one great way to figure out what to do was to listen to people. So people on the commission, some staff from the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, some great undergraduate students right here from UW-Madison helped us out in facilitating these conversations where we asked questions that were based on this platform that I've helped develop with this nonprofit called Cortico. The platform was called Fora, and the idea is you just ask people big questions like, what are your concerns? What do you hope for? What do you wish would be different about your life 5 years from now? And what do you want people in power to hear about the challenges that you're facing? So there was a wide range of people in many corners of the country.
Now, you shared actual audio of some of the responses you got. I want to listen to one of these now. We've got a teacher you talked to in rural Tennessee. Here it is.
I just said I was at my fullest potential. Probably, you know, 5 minutes ago, and I'm still like, you know, one doctor's visit away from not being there. And pretty much most people I know are.
So one doctor's visit away from not being in good shape economically. This is something I've heard over the years, the idea that people feel precarious. It may not even matter where they are on the income scale. One big change could put somebody into potentially poverty.
Yeah, and that the idea of like when you wonder when are people going to feel like the economy is good and when they're doing well in the economy, basically people just are looking for some level of stability, right? Some ability to plan, to save, and for lots of folks that's just not possible. They're on a weekly, monthly basis struggling to make ends meet, and they just don't have the bandwidth to really save or plan, much less, you know, make ends meet sometimes. So, you know, her statement in the end, she's saying like, I'm one doctor's visit away from disaster. And most people I know are. It's common, right? She's at the same time talking about, I just a moment ago said I'm at kind of at my the peak of my economic well-being. And yet, I feel like I'm on the edge of disaster.
And beyond the obvious, like, economic impact, if you have that doctor's visit that wipes out all your economic gains, I want to quote from your piece here. An absence of economic resilience prevents people from spending time with family, from getting involved in their community, and from finding ways to build a safety net. So it's not just the obvious problem of you run out of money, but this follow-on effect that hurts us as a society.
Yeah, and so we asked people, you know, what would a good economy look like? And people just want, like you said, time with their family. They want a little bit of time to do something other than work. They want time to just be well in whatever way they define that. And our economy currently, that's not what it's built for. It's not built for the average American's well-being.
Kathy Kramer is with us from UW-Madison, political scientist there. She's been involved in a research project talking to actual people about how they experience the economy. You can join in with your response to some of the things you're hearing now at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Daryl is with us in Menominee Falls. Daryl, hi.
Hi. I wanted to say that I believe that the politicians in Madison and Washington are so far removed from reality. They seem to be passing all kinds of legislation that's in favor of large corporations, huge tax breaks, and the working class people are still struggling to make ends meet. And it doesn't seem like there's any connection with the politicians about what people are going through every day just to make, just to earn a living.
Damn.
And I don't think the politicians could live on $15 an hour themselves. I'd like to see them do that.
Daryl, thank you so much for the call. This echoes, I think, a lot of what you've heard, Kathy.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you, Daryl. Yeah, that was a pretty widespread sentiment. And it might interest you to know that one of our recommendations was actually to foster training for working class folks so they can run for office and have their views in the mix and have their experiences part of the policymaking, because there are very few people of working class background serving in any level of government in the United States right now.
Thanks a lot for that call, Daryl. Flipping things around, are you hoping that politicians and other decision makers take something away from the conversations you've had with people around the country?
Definitely. And I'm happy to say that when you having an op-ed in the New York Times helps get a little bit of notice. And so it is sparking some conversations with policymakers. And we're not in the business of lobbying with this report, and that's not what the American Academy of Arts and Sciences does. But we hope that what we heard can be informative to people in policy making power, right? So that they can learn from what we heard.
Thanks again for that call, Daryl. And here's another clip from one of the people you talked to. This is somebody in Kentucky, I think with some of the same themes as Daryl. Here's a listen.
I just feel like the underdog can't get ahead, and it's all about greed and profit.
And in your New York Times piece, it seems like that greed theme came through loud and clear for you.
It really did, because one of the questions we asked people was, what values do you think drive the economy? And almost always, people said, I'm sorry to laugh, but people said without skipping a beat, well, greed, you know, the profit motive. And the values driving our economy are not, you know, what can we do to make sure all people thrive in this country? Instead, people talked a lot about greed.
Now, I almost pulled a clip from the movie Wall Street, the famous Michael Douglas's Gordon Gekko, his greed is good speech. I mean, there's a political and economic argument that says greed is good. It drives innovation. It's something that a rising tide lifts all boats eventually. I mean, did people confront that kind of thinking that, hey, freeing up rich people to get richer may have a benefit for everybody?
There definitely were conversations about growth. Like, isn't growth a good thing, and doesn't that help everybody out in the end? And sometimes people connected that to greed, but I'd say more often a question of does growth have to be about greed? Mm-hmm. You know, can't we find a way to create jobs that actually help communities thrive in terms of enabling people to do work that's meaningful to them, that allows them to live their values as opposed to crushing their soul.
And then on the opposite end, I think, of the political spectrum, the argument is, hey, if everybody feels precarious economically, we need a stronger social safety net. Did people talk in those terms at all when you talked to them?
Not so much, to be honest. I mean, at times, but it was more a kind of bewilderment with the system as a whole. It was sort of disgruntlement with employers, with mm-hmm. the banking system, not just with government and what the government is or is not providing. Mm-hmm. Just so when people told us that they thought the system was rigged, they're not just talking about politicians. They're talking about the private sector and many different sectors of the country.
Kathy Kramer is with us, professor of political science at UW-Madison, co-chair of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences Commission on Reimagining Our Economy. She's with us for a look at how Americans are feeling about the economy. She's just written up a long-term project talking to people around the country about how the economy impacts them, why they may feel a mismatch between the good numbers you see in the headlines and their realities. Join in at 800-642-1234 to share your perspective on this. When you see positive reports about the economy, low unemployment numbers, Wall Street looking pretty good, a stock market going up, inflation finally tapering off, do you feel that? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with UW-Madison political scientist Kathy Kramer about why Americans feel like the economy is not great for them. They feel precarious despite sunny reports and many economic indicators. She's been talking to people all around the country about their personal, their family economies. Join in at 800-642-1234 with your report on how you feel about the economy. If you feel like things are stable or things are precarious for your economic future, join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on another caller now. Bethany is with us in Durand. Bethany, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Bethany?
So I think one of the things being middle class that I've noticed with the economy is that the things that we're often doing for pleasure, especially with our family, going out to eat, buying, you know, chips or some snack foods, going out to a concert, those things are now becoming out of reach for middle class. You go to McDonald's, and for a family of four, it's over $30. And meanwhile, these companies are making record profits. And it's really just really discouraging.
Bethany, thanks a lot for the call. Kathy, again, yeah. This is the kind of thing you're hearing.
Yeah, I mean, I know you can't see me, Bethany, but I'm nodding my head as you're talking. And we heard that a lot, and that perception of you know, how can it be tough for me to buy a bag of chips for my family when clearly there's lots of wealth in this country, right? It's difficult for people to square. And so that's just another reason why it's not a mystery that people don't think the economy is doing great, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it may be doing great in the abstract, but in our own personal lives, not so much.
Thanks for that call. I want to listen to another person you talked to. This one's an HR employee in Indiana talking about, you know, and this is something I think you heard from a lot of people. You don't need to be rich, but what does financial well-being sound like? Here's a listen.
Financial well-being is, for me, is basically being able to take care of my everyday expenses and also having like emergency savings, because the way the economy is going right now, you don't know where it's going to be, you know, tomorrow, next week. So yeah, it's basically about being financially stable. It's not about being rich, but it's about being able to take care of your everyday needs without, you know, stressing.
Okay, a lot in there, Kathy.
Yeah, I mean, that level of uncertainty, right? Like in any aspect of our lives, when we experience uncertainty, I mean, it can turn to anxiety, right? And it's this undertone of worry that makes life a little bit more tough, a little less enjoyable. And that lack of a cushion is just very common for lots of folks.
Thanks again for that call. Mike joins us now in Madison. Mike, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. The Wisconsin state unemployment system, the amount that it pays people who get laid off or let go from work is historically at a very low level. It doesn't keep up with the rent payments or the payments for gas and cell phone bills. I don't think they've changed the amounts in 20 or 30 years. And if you take a look at the surrounding states, Wisconsin's maximum unemployment compensation is roughly half of what it is for Minnesota. And it just creates a spiraling effect where people can't pay their bills, they've been let go, and then they're counting on the safety net, and the safety net isn't there for them.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. Kathy?
Yeah, we definitely heard a lot about that, and we heard a lot about how, two things about the safety nets that are in place. One, you know, people feeling like they're not set up to really get people back on their feet, much less help them thrive. And a lot of times there's what people call these cliff effects, where if you start to earn a little bit more and suddenly you're bumped off of unemployment benefits or bumped off of welfare or, housing support, it's a lot of the safety net programs are difficult to navigate and not what a lot of people feel like they would need to really have a stable footing and get back on their feet and get ahead, much less get ahead. Yeah.
Thanks for that call, Mike. On a related note, here's one of the participants you talked to in Chicago about where you were just talking about making too much money, maybe getting knocked off a program.
It's like you can get the benefits if you're living at or below the poverty line. Right. And we know that number is seriously low. But for the people such as myself who are the working class, it knocks me out of a lot of the opportunity to qualify for a lot of the programs that could assist in benefiting myself and my child in order for us to make ends meet. And that is, a huge barrier.
Is this part of a solution here, Kathy? I know some programs taper, like I think the Earned Income Tax Credit and some other things, health subsidies under the Affordable Care Act. I mean, yeah. Is that part of a solution instead of yes or no, a gradation?
Yeah, just having these cutoffs where just earning one more dollar overnight bumps you off. It's not working for people.
Thanks a lot for the call. Back to our callers. Dave is with us in Toma. Dave, hi.
Yeah, I don't see anything wrong with greed. If it wasn't for greed, we wouldn't have the economy that we do today. And being a landlord, I see so many tenants that scam the system. They collect benefits and they work besides. And I've got other renters that they just do the very minimum they can do to get by, and then they complain that they're not getting enough. Everybody's different. If somebody wants to make it, I always had two jobs in my life. And I just don't have a lot of sympathy for people that aren't making ends meet.
Dave, thanks a lot for the call. Did you hear that that pushback from some of the people you talked to?
I suppose a bit. But as the caller was saying, everybody's different and is going to view these issues differently. But I wonder, people who maybe be worthwhile if more tenants and landlords had the opportunity to listen to one another. Mm-hmm. I bet it's pretty rare.
Thanks, Dave, for calling in. Victoria is with us in Marinette. Victoria, hi.
Hi. My comment was that I'm 69 years old, and my comment was that we got along just fine with a regular telephone. We paid our doctor bills. We didn't have insurance. And, we didn't have to go to football games that cost, $150 a ticket. We kind of brought this situation on ourselves.
Victoria, thanks for the call. Is this something about our changing expectations? But then again, doctor's visits cost a lot more than they used to, Kathy.
Yeah, well, it's a great question that we both, just what we want to consume has changed over time for sure, as have housing prices and the cost of a lot of goods that we need. And that the sentiment of, you know, things used to be different is common. I mean, people definitely spoke a lot about how it used to be easier to get by.
Thanks a lot for that call. Kathy, in just our last little less than a minute now, what's one takeaway, again, that you're hoping policymakers get out of your work here?
Honestly, to listen more. It's kind of expensive in a way because it takes time and you have to give people the opportunity to reflect. You have to give them your time. But it's remarkable what you learn when you just pause and invite people to share their concerns and their challenges and their hopes. I'm speaking to the choir here on WPR. Thank you very much. But I hope they listen.
Kathy, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's always an honor.
Kathy Kramer is a professor of political science at UW-Madison and co-chair of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences Commission on Reimagining Our Economy. We've been talking about her research into our attitudes on the economy and why many Americans she interviewed feel like the economy is not in their favor in spite of, you know, the positive headlines you might see about the economy.